Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 93. It's Monday, December 21st. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Okay, well, good news in the COVID epidemic here in our country. The Moderna vaccine begins going into arms this week. Well, last week, the Pfizer vaccine was introduced and Ohio got 98,000 doses, and they managed to get about 6,700 of those into the arms of mostly healthcare workers. Getting their first dose, they'll need another one in a few weeks. Okay, well, the vaccine rollout has been plagued from the get-go with less supply than expected on a variety of things. There was some goof up in communications logistically that states were reporting a lot less. So the rollout keeps being cranked down as far as the expectations. One of the most interesting stories I heard this week, in fact, one of the many, I don't number them, but another kind of tragic story that we have with this epidemic is that actually the two vaccines that we have now, the Pfizer and the Moderna, are mRNA vaccines. And some of the components that these vaccines need are exactly the same components that we need to produce COVID-19 testing kits. They use the same limited reagents, the components needed to make them. So one of the problems we may have as we go on in cranking up vaccine production is that it's going to have to compete with producing test kits. Okay, well, in fact, what I believe the most important story in COVID, definitely this week, and if this turns out to be a serious actuality, this could be the story of several months, maybe even of the epidemic. This from Time. A new, more contagious COVID-19 strain has been reported in the UK. Is it headed for the US? A new strain of COVID-19 reported in the United Kingdom has been blamed for a sharp uptick of cases, prompting new lockdowns in London and more than 40 countries to ban cross-border travel from the UK. Although scientists say there is no evidence that the new strain is more deadly, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said it could be up to 70% more transmissible than other variants, while the health secretary said it was, quote, getting out of control. At least 40 countries, including the entire European Union and Canada, have temporarily banned incoming travel from the UK. And the new strain has been detected in Denmark, Australia, and Gibraltar, according to British reports, and in Italy and Netherlands, according to other media reports. But the US has so far not stopped incoming travelers from the UK or Europe, sparking fears that may have already crossed the Atlantic Ocean. Today, that variant is getting on a plane and landing at JFK, said New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on December 20th, referring to New York's busiest airport. How many times in life do you have to make the same mistake before you learn? Yeah, seriously. And Trump, of course, is always touting his early ban of travel from China. But if this, in fact, is significantly more transmissible, and 70% would be profoundly, significantly more transmissible. But even 20% is bad news. So apparently this strain has been found in other countries, so it's probably already out there. But keeping this tamped down, this new strain, could be a whole nother huge layer on top of epidemic control. And of course, it's a cross-international issue since it seems to be concentrated in the UK right now. Now, of course, a lot of those reports have talked about, oh, well, it's not any more serious, but the seriousness of this pandemic is only somewhat related to the chance of any particular individual getting sick or dying if they get infected. The overall death rates are driven by the number, the proportion, the percentage of people in the population who actually get infected. And if we have a new strain that's way more infected, it's more dangerous from a public health point of view, where our patient is the population. So if you get 20% more people infected, it is 20% more dangerous at least. And if it puts additional strains on the healthcare system, it can be even more so, because your death rates go up when healthcare supplies get limited and quality of care necessarily goes down. Okay, well, the next story I wanted to do is, I've been commenting and covering on the effects in rural areas, which are actually the most hard hit areas in the U.S. right now, although it's kind of hard to tell, it's pretty much everywhere. But this from Reuters. She collapsed in her kitchen from COVID-19. The next day, she was nearly 300 miles from home. A few days after getting a positive COVID-19 test in late November, Sherry collapsed in her kitchen floor in rural Wisconsin. The next day, she was at a hospital in North Dakota, a nearly 300-mile drive from her family. "How the F am I going to get home?" Sherry's daughter, Erica, said. Her mom told her over the phone from the hospital, laughing between labored breaths. "And my mom does not say the F word," she added. Her local hospital in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, was overwhelmed by the coronavirus surges hitting the region in November and did not have the capacity or resources to treat her. So they called around and found the closest hospital that did, Essentia Health in Fargo, North Dakota. After staying in her local hospital for a few hours, Sherry was put in a futuristic transparent oxygen hood, driven about 12 miles to the airport, and loaded onto a propeller plane. Sherry's situation is not unique. As the coronavirus increasingly hammered rural areas in recent months, the small hospitals that serve those areas have found themselves with too many patients, too few beds, and not enough staff to deal with the situations. So they have started airlifting them to any hospital that can take them, no matter the distance, scattering rural patients all over the country. Rural hospitals often have a small staff, limited beds, and limited resources. 61% of rural hospitals don't even have intensive care units, the National Rural Health Association found. So even before the pandemic, patients in rural areas facing life-threatening illnesses often had to be transported to faraway urban hospitals. For a while, Sherry wasn't sure how she would get home. Much of her family had the virus as well. And though they were feeling okay, they were still under quarantine and shouldn't be doing a multi-state road trip. But she ended up being in the hospital for longer than she imagined, nearly 2 weeks. By the time the hospital was ready to discharge her, her husband Jeff could make the trip. On Monday, Jeff got the call that Sherry could come home. He jumped in the car at 5:30 a.m. the next day and drove 13 hours there and back, making pit stops on the way to make sure Sherry was okay. The couple is on Medicare and have supplemental coverage that should mean that they won't be charged more than a few hundred dollars for Sherry's treatment and her emergency flight to North Dakota, Jeff said, which they can afford. Many aren't so lucky. Sometimes a rural ambulance will drive hundreds of miles to drop a patient off at a city hospital that can treat them properly. Without proper insurance, this can cost the patient thousands of dollars and leave their county without any ambulances for hours at a time, said Brock Slabach, the National Rural Health Association Senior Vice President of Member Services. Long delays in getting proper care can worsen a patient's condition, especially with the unpredictable crashes that often accompany severe COVID cases, Slabach said. If the hospital is too far for a drive, the patient could be looking at even higher bills. The financial component of an air transfer is very difficult. You're looking at sometimes $30,000 to $40,000, Slabach said, who used to set up similar transfers as a rural hospital administrator. And many times we're finding commercial insurances don't pay for air transport, so that's left for the patient to meet. Once they've recovered, insurance often doesn't pay for the trip back home. Discharge planners, hospital staff who help figure out the best way to transfer a patient out of the hospital, can often help patients navigate this problem, but they have become overwhelmed during the pandemic as well. Not only do they have more patients than they used to, but they're from all over the country and have complex, long, and unpredictable recovery needs. Then there's the burden on the families, emotional and financial. Families feel so helpless in this situation to begin with. And then you add that distance. Elena Knutson, director of the Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis, said in an interview, being that far away is even harder because there's no chance to go visit somebody if any last-minute issue arises, unless you're staying in a hotel nearby, which isn't financially viable for many people. Okay, well, as the epidemic rages, the number of people cooperating with contact tracers is actually at problematic levels. This story from NewJersey.com. 78% of those infected with coronavirus refused to help with contact tracing in New Jersey. The number of people in New Jersey who refuse to cooperate with coronavirus contact tracers is hitting new heights. 78% of people who were contacted by the state's more than 3,300 tracers last week wouldn't work with them, Governor Phil Murphy said. It's up from 74% of people who refused the prior week. I ask you again, I implore you, if one of our contact tracers calls, work with them, Murphy said during his latest COVID-19 briefing in Trenton. No one is out on a witch hunt, Murphy said. No one doubts that you have only the best of intentions when you say, it's okay, I'll call my friends on my own. But this is a time when a trained public health expert needs to be in the lead. Murphy has called the process of tracing extremely critical to slow the surge of the virus. He also stressed that contact tracers are professionals who have been trained to answer questions related to the coronavirus when they speak to residents who may have been exposed. We have done everything we can to give our communities the tools to fight COVID, he said. And yet, they hit walls because the people they are trained to help aren't helping them.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, next up from the Hill. Political division is dangerously defining our COVID-19 conversation. With more than 30 years as a pollster and with 2 decades of work in public health, the two of us never have been more afraid. 10 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, we have a partisan political chasm when it comes to how Americans perceive and act towards the pandemic. More than 150 years ago, Abraham Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." After 300,000 deaths and counting, we are learning the hard way that a country divided cannot effectively manage a pandemic either. But a new poll we conducted recently shows that changing the way we talk about the pandemic can profoundly impact the behavior changes needed to help eliminate COVID-19, restore public trust, improve compliance with public health safety protocols, yes, call them protocols, and ultimately save lives and get our lives and our economy, in that order, back to normal. Polarizing, combative rhetoric has brought our nation to where we are today. Until we have the right messaging, we simply will not close the divides that have erupted across every possible demographic and attitudinal fault line. But as language has driven much of our divide, a better lexicon may be our most valuable tool. Our research offers 4 insights about how our leaders can improve the way we talk about the pandemic and how, in turn, we can get everyone to take the steps required to eliminate COVID-19 in the United States. First, we need to balance our language between health and the economy. To no one's surprise, Republican voters are much more skeptical of the virus and its impact than Democratic voters or the broader public. Republicans also are much more hostile about the need for additional, quote, lockdowns. Please call it stay-at-home protocols and their significant impact on the economy. Only 12% of Democratic voters prioritize the national economy over the health and safety of the nation, compared to 51% of Republican voters. Since the pandemic began, we have been arguing over a false dichotomy between fighting the virus or supporting the economy. It is a false and misleading choice that has failed to serve the interests of either side. We must protect not only our physical, but our economic well-being. We need to continually balance our language between the economy and health. While health is more persuasive, ignoring economic anxiety ignores the voices of roughly 40% of Americans for whom this is their primary concern, in some cases, a crippling one. Our leaders should emphasize that following public health protocols will help to avoid severe limits and restrictions, and that it will speed up the return to a healthy, inclusive economy. Second, it's time for politicians and politics to step aside. Political leaders have been dominating the airwaves and the briefing rooms. Yet, despite their best efforts, the words and phrases they've embraced are missing the mark, failing to motivate millions of Americans who still do not realize their lives and the lives of their family are in jeopardy. The problem is not just what they say, but who they are. If you're an elected official, you are immediately tainted. Everyone is watching and listening for some partisan bias. Please don't taint the research and science by sharing it through a partisan lens. Americans trust recommendations from medical and public health officials above everyone else, specifically because their opinions are shaped by science, not politics. 35% of respondents believe COVID-19 decisions should come from the nation's highest-ranking medical and public health officials, followed by 28% who want their state officials to make those decisions. Whenever we can inject local control into the conversation, and mean it, it will bolster our efforts. People simply have more faith in public health experts delivering localized solutions. Conversely, only 20% said they trusted elected officials. It would be far better for all of us if they stood in the background and let the experts do their jobs, publicly and privately. If they must speak, everything they say should be fact-based and decidedly neutral, with absolutely no hint of politics. As for healthcare CEOs, they've made the media rounds championing their corporate successes. It would be far better for them, their shareholders, and all the rest of us if they took a back seat and let their chief scientists and researchers speak for them. The CEOs are seen as being about profit. The scientists and researchers they employ are about us. Third, voters are interested in supporting leaders for acting on COVID-19. Only 7% of swing voters and 11% of Republican voters said they would be less likely to vote for a member of Congress who encouraged people to take tangible steps, which may include personal sacrifice, to stop the spread of COVID-19. The U.S. confirmed more than 200,000 new COVID cases for the first time on November 27th. Elected leaders must come together to pass the legislation and make the funding available to support our nation's efforts to eradicate COVID-19, realizing that will be an electoral boon, not a bust across the political spectrum across time. Fourth, we need to give people a reason to comply with public health protocols beyond the fact that it's good for them. We need to make COVID-19 tangible by individualizing, personalizing, and humanizing the pandemic. Coronavirus does exactly the opposite. Before talking about reopening the economies and schools, start by emphasizing the shared goal of returning to normal. That's what Americans really want. The economy is about others. Returning to normal is about us. We also need to speak of the consequences of failure. For example, 40% of Democrats and 35% of Republicans agree that COVID-19 is highly infectious, and both are compelled by the statement that one infection can quickly grow into an outbreak that could shutter a neighborhood, community, or entire city. Everybody wants a safe and sensible path forward, and while not everyone agrees that proper behavior is a national duty, the red and blue states share a belief and a commitment to personal responsibility. Elected leaders also must follow the guidance which they promote or risk undermining those efforts. Governors, mayors, and other elected officials were not following their own advice by choosing to dine indoors or travel during Thanksgiving. This hypocrisy is fodder for pandemic skeptics. Eliminating COVID-19 will take sacrifices, remaining distant from family, avoiding activities that we enjoy and that are central to our lives, from all of us. To ask this of the American public means that everyone must take personal responsibility. Do as I say, but not as I do, will perpetuate the pandemic and cost lives. We all have a part to play in eliminating COVID-19, but we will not truly work together until we have a language that brings us together. Whether we are talking on the nightly news, posting on social media, or simply meeting a friend for a socially distanced coffee, we each will be doing our part to eliminate COVID-19 and return to normal. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update. Looking at Lucas County average daily cases over the last 7 days, we went on a little bit of roller coaster the last month, going from about 347 to about 300, up to 474. Now we're back down to 275. So we did have a big drop in the last week, which is really good. Although the testing seems to be a little bit of a mess, I think this is good news. It's kind of hard to tell from the local data because if you look at the most recent 2 weeks, we actually have a positivity rate of 82%, which is higher than the 74% before. But of course, as I've spoken before, I'll say again, they're not really reporting negative tests for possibly weeks. So we're getting a lot of positive tests, but the negative tests, which allows you to calculate the total number of tests that were done, lag a whole lot. So we don't really know what the positivity rate is, but when it's 82% over a 2 week period, something's awry here. And the total number of tests over the last 2 weeks has gone down over the last week from about 530 tests a week to 425 tests a day. 530 down to 425. And that's about as low as we've gone. That's kind of a baseline that we had like over the summer, was something closer to that. And the week before that, so a couple weeks ago, we were doing an average of 870 tests a day. In Ohio, testing has remained stable the last couple weeks, but the good news is that our positivity rate, the percentage of people that get tested that actually end up being positive, has gone down. It is 13.9%, still way higher than the 5% that's recommended that we should be under, but it's down from over 15% the last couple weeks, so that's good. And locally, for the amount of time it takes for a positive test result to be returned, it took an average of 3.9 days to get to the health department, and from the previous week, that was down from 4.4 days. So it can kind of bounce up and down. But of course, around 4 days is quite a long time if you're going to be able to do contact tracing. But it looks like our contact tracers are going to be moved to vaccination stuff. And that job's going to switch to another crew of people, probably part-time volunteers. Maybe the state, the Ohio Department of Health, is going to help out. Not entirely clear what that is, but we have a little shift there. So we'll see how contact tracing goes. Okay, nursing homes, the most dangerous place to be in this pandemic. Well, unfortunately, we did set a new record with 207 active cases. That was 116 residents and 91 staff over the most recent week. That's up from 190 the previous week, and the week before that it was 146, and the week before that it was 161, which up to that point was the highest number we'd had in the months that we've kept data since May. Okay, well, last week I reported that they had not updated the positivity rate for the long-term care facilities. We did get that number, and it was 21.3%. That was up from 19.4%. And then this most recent week, it was 19.9%. So we're running around 20% positivity in the long-term care facilities. That is really high. Very dangerous. Okay, while our cases are going down, the Lucas County death rate has been holding steady, and it is above the state and national death rates. We've had 52 deaths in the last 14 days, and that was the same as last week. The previous 14 days had 52 deaths. So holding steady there. Now, some comparison. I was actually comparing, you hear a lot about Los Angeles and California now. They're seeing cases really rise and their hospital systems really being taxed. We actually have a higher death rate now than Los Angeles. And this was actually true early on in the epidemic. Now, that will probably change because their rates are skyrocketing, where ours seem to be leveling off or roller coasting, but at least they're not, you know, on this unending rise like we saw earlier, where it looked like whoa. So hopefully we've got some better news there, but just for some comparison, right now actually we're worse than Los Angeles. Little Lucas County. Okay, well, last week we had a new data source from the Department of Health and Human Services from the feds about hospitals. And I pulled up that data today, which just came out today, and I was looking at it, and it was very different. There was some missing data And this was about the percent of people in the hospital that have COVID and the proportion of people in the ICU that have COVID. But it was way different. So I'm going to actually take a look at that before I report any more of that, try to sort out that data source. But the good news is from the state of Ohio, we seem to reach a peak the middle of last week for hospitalizations, and that's come down a bit. So it seems that the long rise in hospitalizations has been reversed. So good news. Okay, last thing, schools. University of Toledo has been out for a couple weeks, but there's still people on campus and they're still doing surveillance. They had 36 positives, and for the hundreds of people that they just test randomly, there was a 1.7% positivity rate. Okay, and Lucas County Schools as well have been virtual, but regardless, there was a record number of staff and students infected at 95 staff and 94 students in the most recent week, and that's up from 85 staff and 85 students the prior week. And that probably reflects just the fact that we have high community transmission. Obviously, they're not meeting in the school building except on a very, very limited basis. Okay, well, I wanted to close out our local report with the status of the state regarding infant mortality and racial disparities. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Despite years of effort to combat infant mortality in Ohio, racial disparity increases. Black babies are dying before their first birthday in Ohio at an even greater rate, nearly three times that of white infants, even though the state's overall infant mortality rate was unchanged last year. The data released last Thursday in a report from the Ohio Department of Health showed that racial disparities are actually getting worse on whether babies surviving their first year of life, despite years of effort to close that gap and reduce infant mortality. That report prompted Governor Mike DeWine to announce the formation of a new task force charged with developing a plan to reduce infant mortality and eliminate racial disparity by 2030. Frankly, we need to do more, the governor said. While the state reported that the 929 babies who died before their first birthday in 2019 was down slightly from 938 a year earlier, the state's 6.9 infant mortality rate, the number of babies who die before their first birthday per 1,000 live births, actually was unchanged because fewer babies were born last year. Among black babies, the infant mortality rate actually increased, though, to 14.3, up from 13.9 a year earlier. That's nearly three times the 5.1 infant mortality rate for white babies. The new task force will begin working in January to, quote, create actionable recommendations for interventions, performance, and quality improvement, data collection, and policies to advise the Governor's Office of Children's Initiatives on improving Ohio's investment and strategies in addressing racial inequities in birth outcomes. A pair of Democratic state lawmakers, both black women, panned DeWine's plan to launch another task force in 2021. Ohio House Minority Leader Amelia Sykes, who has a master's degree in public health, posted on Twitter, "We already know the strategies to end disparities in infant mortality. We don't need another task force. We need actions. We appreciate all of you who are new to health disparities, but I sincerely ask that you follow the people who've been doing this work. Our babies can't wait." Fellow Ohio House member Representative Erica Crawley, Democrat from Columbus, had similar feelings. In a thread she posted on Twitter, Crawley implored DeWine to, quote, "listen to black women. We know why babies, especially black babies, are dying. This is yet another attempt to continue to kick that can down the road," she wrote. Efforts to tackle the perplexing problem aren't new. In his 2011 State of the State address, then-Governor John Kasich announced an effort to combat infant mortality. And lo and behold, I remember my days at the health department when I was a health planner around the turn of the millennium. And one of the things we did back then was we started an infant mortality task force where we dug into the data. But I'll tell you, we have learned a lot since then. But this is a really good story to kind of highlight again, to kind of a medical reductionistic approach to healthcare versus a public health approach. Like I've reported on this show many times before, and I'm not going to get into details, but if you want to go back to previous shows, go back to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, scroll through the shows and look for stories on black infant mortality. I've done a lot of reporting on this. The fact is, racism is a public health issue, and that discrimination and the stress of chronic racism and institutional biases within healthcare and a broader society impact Black women profoundly. And that's actually independent of like socioeconomic status. If you are a well-educated, wealthy Black woman, you still experience this disparity. So this is not something that can be cured by a simple clinical effort. It takes a much broader approach. And as these two representatives are pointing out, we need to go big in on this if we're going to deal with this in a way that really works. And that's more than just another task force. Okay, well, vaccines, as you know, are all the rage in the media. So let's do a few stories talking about that and broaden our perspective to look actually worldwide. So this from Stat News. Emergency use authorization of COVID-19 vaccines could hinder global access to them. Within a span of 10 days, regulators in the United Kingdom and the United States granted emergency use authorization for the COVID-19 vaccine made by Pfizer and BioNTech. This vaccine, reported to be 95% effective, is now being rolled out across both countries. And as I write this, the U.S. is poised to approve a second COVID-19 vaccine, this one made by Moderna. It will likely take far longer for this vaccine to be available in sub-Saharan Africa, partly because its use was approved with emergency use authorizations instead of the developers pursuing full licenses. Previous efforts to expedite COVID-19 vaccine approval, such as Operation Warp Speed, were met with concerns about safety. In response, the largest vaccine developers pledged to submit their vaccine candidates for approval only after passing Phase 3 trials showed a vaccine's effectiveness. However, after early results of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine candidate trial were announced, the developers reneged on their assurances and said they would push ahead for emergency use authorization from the FDA, relying only on preliminary results before the completion of the Phase 3 trial. While these moves could be welcomed by people living in the UK and the US, the emergency authorizations will have serious consequences for lower-income countries, creating a ripple effect that could deny them access to COVID-19 vaccines for months to come. Because there is likely to be a shortage of vaccine doses around the world, a country can give itself an advantage by granting an emergency use authorization and then begin procuring doses without competing demand from other countries. In the case of the United Arab Emirates, the emergency use authorization enabled the country to procure doses without having to compete with other countries who had not approved the vaccine. Expediting approvals, including emergency use authorizations, may be an option for wealthier countries, but they are not something poor countries can emulate. In low and middle income countries, the timelines for approval of new vaccines tend to be significantly longer than in countries like the U.S. A recent study found a delay of 4 to 7 years between the first regulatory submission for any type of treatment or health technology, usually a high income country, and the final approval in sub-Saharan Africa. This delay occurs because approvals for drugs and vaccines in the regions tend to follow a three-step process. Initial approval in a high-income country, such as the U.S., is followed by pre-qualification by the World Health Organization, and finally approved by a country's own regulator. The use of emergency approvals poses a particular problem for the pipeline of COVID-19 vaccines. Because the standards for emergency use approval are significantly lower than the norm, the World Health Organization cannot use them for pre-qualification, blocking regulators in lower-income countries from approving these vaccines. This means that even if there is a highly effective vaccine, if it is given emergency use authorization, lower-income countries might not be able to approve it for use for their citizens. Delays in approving and rolling out COVID-19 vaccines in poor countries is made more complicated for those purchasing vaccines through the COVAX mechanism, an advanced market commitment that aims to provide lower-income countries with COVID-19 vaccines at affordable prices. In its initial contractual terms, COVAX had committed to only purchasing vaccines that are fully licensed or have been pre-qualified by the World Health Organization, which excludes vaccines that have received only emergency use authorizations. These were later amended to allow countries to choose to accept vaccines approved under emergency use authorization. Though this allowance may provide a route to access for some countries, poor countries with limited regulatory capacity may struggle to locally approve vaccines for rollout if only an emergency use authorization has been granted. There are certainly valid reasons why a country would grant emergency use authorization for COVID-19 therapeutics or vaccines, given the death and disruption the pandemic has caused this year. In a situation where there are few treatment options, lowering the threshold for approving treatments is better than providing no options. However, to control the pandemic, the whole world needs a truly effective vaccine to be distributed equitably. While emergency use approvals from the FDA in the U.S., the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency in the U.K., and other agencies in high-income countries will lead to earlier access to COVID-19 drugs and vaccines for their citizens, there is a need to ensure that they won't block the approval pipeline for low- and middle-income countries. The pledge by pharmaceutical companies to pursue full licensure would have addressed this problem, but in reality, vaccine developers are now attempting to roll out candidates as quickly as possible. The European Medicines Agency has departed from the trend adopted in many other countries. Instead of allowing emergency use authorizations for COVID-19 vaccines, it is choosing to pursue full licensing, even though this will delay vaccine rollouts. This will ensure safer vaccines, and poor countries can rely on this license to approve the vaccines themselves. Having regulatory agencies or developers themselves opt to pursue full licenses for the COVID-19 vaccines will ensure they are accessible to all. What the European Medicines Agency is doing should be the norm. The preference for granting emergency use authorization to expedite rollouts of COVID-19 vaccines poses immense difficulties for poor countries and will likely delay their access to these life-saving agents. If pharmaceutical companies commit to pursuing full licenses from stringent regulatory authorities like the FDA in the U.S., they can help ensure that effective vaccines are accessible not only in those countries but around the world as well. Only then will the world be considered safe again. Yes, my friends, this is a pandemic. In one sense, we're really all in this together, but of course, reality is much more stratified than that. And in a related story from Stat News, one quarter of the world may not get a COVID-19 vaccine until 2022, experts warn. As wealthy governments race to lock in supplies of COVID-19 vaccines, nearly a quarter of the world's population, mostly in low- and middle-income countries, will not have access to a shot until 2022, according to a new analysis. As of mid-November, high-income countries, including the European Union bloc, reserve 51% of nearly 7.5 billion doses of different COVID-19 vaccines, although these countries comprise just 14% of the world population. Meanwhile, only 6 of the 13 manufacturers working on COVID-19 vaccine candidates have reached agreements to sell their shots to low- and middle-income countries at all. The analysis, which was published in the British Medical Journal, noticed that access varies markedly across these countries. For instance, the U.S. reserved 800 million doses, but accounted for 1/5 of all COVID-19 cases globally. By contrast, Japan, Australia, and Canada reserved more than 1 billion doses, though these three countries combined did not account for even 1% of all current cases. Looked at another way, the projected vaccine courses per capita by country show Canada, followed by Australia, the UK, Japan, the European Union, and the US, have reserved at least one vaccine course per person. Canada has reserved 9.5 doses, or well over 4 courses per person. By contrast, low- to middle-income countries such as Brazil and Indonesia reserve less than 1 course for every 2 people. Meanwhile, only high- and middle-income countries have been able to procure mRNA vaccines, notably the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. The Pfizer vaccine has secured emergency use in the U.S. and other countries, but both it and the Moderna vaccine require cold chain distribution and storage, which means they may not be readily available in countries with limited infrastructure. High-income countries have sought to secure future supplies of COVID-19 vaccines, but have left much of the rest of the world with uncertain access. Those hopes are today focused on a handful of lead vaccine candidates, some of which might yet falter or fail, wrote the authors. However, some contracts have not been disclosed or are heavily redacted, making it difficult to pinpoint supply priorities. The authors argued that greater transparency is needed about manufacturer agreements, as well as underlying research and development costs, public sector financing, and pricing arrangements in order to achieve more equitable access. Such limited transparency will fuel concerns about vaccine nationalism and planning and accountability for ensuring broader access to COVID-19 vaccines could be seriously encumbered, the authors warned. The situation is compounded by the different priorities for allocation in each country and region. According to another analysis in the same issue of the British Medical Journal, for instance, if vaccines are preferentially allocated to priority workers to help maintain societal functions, the global target population is 260 million people. The analysis arrive amid increasing concern over access to affordable COVID-19 vaccines now being distributed by Pfizer. the first to win regulatory authorization in the U.S. As anticipation builds, there's that still more vaccines will become available in the next several months, there's still a growing push by some government and consumer groups for greater access. For instance, 100 advocacy groups, academics, and health experts from around the world urge the chief executives of 15 vaccine makers in the U.S., Europe, China, and Russia to commit some of their output to low- and middle-income countries. They also ask the companies to disclose trial results, various costs, prices, advance purchase commitments, and resources received from public and charitable sources. One reason for such missives is that an ambitious program organized by the World Health Organization called COVAX, which hoped to provide vaccines to 92 low- and middle-income countries, has not met all of its goals. As of last month, $2 billion was pledged by the European Commission, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and others. But another $5 billion is still needed to finance the targeted 2 billion doses by the end of 2021. As the study authors noted, by pooling resources and candidate vaccines, COVAX can provide access to a diversified pool of potential vaccines and economies of scale. But there is concern some countries may double dip or purchase supplies through both COVAX and individual agreements. COVAX, by the way, is jointly run with the Gavi Vaccine Alliance and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. So far, about 80 countries have committed to purchasing vaccines. To date, the number of confirmed purchases of COVID-19 vaccines worldwide totaled 7.4 billion doses, according to the Duke Global Health Information Center. Of those, high-income countries purchased 3.9 billion doses, upper-middle-income countries secured 1 billion doses, and lower-middle-income countries contracted for 1.8 billion doses. Low-income countries bought none. COVAX secured 700 million doses. Countries, not COVAX, are purchasing nearly all the output that is being produced and is projected to be produced in 2021. Countries pay more per dose on their own than they were to procure collectively via COVAX, but purchasing directly secures a space forward the front of the queue, wrote Kenneth Shadlin, professor of international development at the London School of Economics, who studies pharmaceutical pricing, patents, and access. The anxiety over access is something of a moving target, though. Earlier this week, the Canadian government committed to provide $380 million to various global initiatives designed to provide equitable access to COVID-19 diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines. Canada has reportedly been in talks to donate excess vaccine doses as well, but no commitment or details have been made public. As the uncertainty diminishes over which vaccines will succeed and which will not, Canada's commitment to ensuring an effective global response will be tested. Anthony So, one of the study authors and a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, wrote, "How and to what point will it share effective COVID-19 vaccines it has procured with those fearing worse in the pandemic or in a greater need of receiving even the first rounds of doses? The same question may face a number of other high-income countries that have entered into bilateral agreements with vaccine manufacturers. Scale up at home or share abroad? Investing and coordinating globally through COVAX can help address this challenge, but the U.S. and Russia have declined to participate. So, Canada's commitment to developing a mechanism for equitably reallocating vaccine doses through COVAX by exchange or donation sets an important first step for the global community to follow." Okay, well, while there's much ado about people who don't want to take the vaccine, there are way more people who want to take the vaccine than vaccine is available. And that gets to this issue brought up by the next article from The Hill. Hospitals boost security, seek to stop vaccine line jumping. Hospitals and healthcare systems are taking unprecedented steps to safeguard the limited supplies of coronavirus vaccines amid concerns over security and the potential for black markets to emerge across the globe. Operation Warp Speed, the government drive to develop and distribute the vaccines, requires medical facilities to develop a security plan. Every dose of vaccine shipped from manufacturing centers in Michigan and Belgium is tracked from the warehouse to hospitals, where they injected in staffers, medical officials said. Extra security personnel and constantly running cameras watch over storage units, where the locks have been upgraded. "We've known from the start that this was going to be a vaccine that's going to be rationed. So we've been thinking all along about how to secure it in a couple of different ways," said Melanie Swift, a physician leading the vaccine rollout at the Mayo Clinic. "That's making sure none of it goes missing." Some doctors and medical officials said they were concerned about rumors of illicit markets for vaccines, in which wealthy individuals might be able to secure a dose for themselves before their turn in line. At least one hospital, Mount Sinai in New York, has hired an external auditor to oversee its vaccine distribution plan. Law enforcement agencies have warned that criminal syndicates may target vaccine supply chains either to steal doses or to run scams meant to steal money. Earlier this month, Interpol's Secretary General warned member nations to identify potential criminal activity around the vaccine. There may be a responsibility to be extra cautious in this case because there might be a pressure to divert this vaccine that institutions ought to be aware of, said Daniel Salmasy, acting director of the Kennedy Institute for Ethics and a biomedical ethics expert at Georgetown University. There may be a reason to be extra careful that that doesn't happen with these. Nearly a year after the pandemic began and months after initial trials of potential vaccine candidates kicked off in countries around the world, the United States is still grappling with ways to keep track of everyone who receives a vaccine. Early on, scarcity helps. The frontline healthcare workers who are first in line for a vaccine are known to the hospitals and that will distribute it, and alerting them that they are eligible is as simple as sending an email. Some hospitals can simply scan badges of those workers in line for a vaccine and check their names off a list. The next in line to receive a vaccine are similarly likely to be easily identified. First responders like police, firefighters, and emergency medical technicians will have government-issued identifications, and those who live in long-term care facilities will be easy enough to identify. But as the vaccine becomes more widely available, the prospects for line jumping will become more prevalent. National vaccine registries exist, but they have never been tested under such immediate and critical conditions. We've had to build new systems in the midst of the pandemic, said Rebecca Weintraub, a vaccine distribution expert in the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. They have not been tested in the midst of a global pandemic. It is not yet clear which subpopulations will be next in line for a vaccine after frontline healthcare workers, first responders, and those living in long-term care facilities. Hospital systems are waiting on guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a body that will make formal recommendations about the order of distribution. About half of the states in the District of Columbia are relying on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Social Vulnerability Index to target those who may be at most risk of contracting the coronavirus. States like Tennessee and New Hampshire are using the index to reserve a portion of the vaccine for those who live in the most vulnerable geographic areas. California is using the index to target people who would be best positioned to help reopen the state's economy. The magnitude of potential impact and benefit is profound, and yet it still needs to be distributed in ways that are balanced and benefit the community at large, said Jane Jankowski, who leads the bioethics team at the Cleveland Clinic. Plans need to be consistent with the general principles of fair distribution of not only the resource, but also the risks and the burdens. In a race to vaccinate hundreds of millions of Americans, it is inevitable that some people receive their shots before their turn comes. But because the end goal is to inoculate so many people, a few line jumpers won't hurt the overall cause. Okay, well, line jumping, or at least attempting to, has begun in the U.S., where the richy rich makes their move. This from the L.A. Times. The wealthy scramble for COVID-19 vaccines. If I donate $25,000, would that help me? They're offering tens of thousands of dollars in cash, making their personal assistants pester doctors every day, and asking whether a five-figure donation to a hospital would help them jump in line. The COVID-19 vaccine is here, and so are the wealthy people who want it first. We get hundreds of calls every day, said Dr. Asan Ali, who runs Beverly Hills Concierge Doctors. His clients, which include Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber, pay between $2,000 and $10,000 a year for personalized care. This is the first time where I've not been able to get something for my patients. Okay, well, expect a lot of complaints.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I've reported a lot on vaccine issues amid communities of color. So here's one more perspective from Stat News. To get the COVID-19 vaccine right, we must close the confidence gap and stop pathologizing communities of color. Broad skepticism about the safety and effectiveness of potential COVID-19 vaccines has created major challenges for policymakers and health officials as they develop vaccine programs. Much of this has been attributed to the anti-vaccine movement and the constant attacks on science by the outgoing presidential administration. When discussions focus on skepticism in communities of color, particularly the Black community, the conversation tends to center around the argument that their distrust is rooted in history and a collective memory of racist policies such as the Tuskegee syphilis experiment and early 20th century forced sterilization policies. This line of thinking is harmful. By focusing on historic wounds, we lose sight of the bigger picture and stifle necessary conversation around larger systemic issues that are worthy of critical analysis. When discussing racism, people in the United States tend to compartmentalize it as mainly a historical problem. This serves age-old racist tropes that pathologize and dismiss communities of color as begrudged monoliths that simply cannot, quote, get over historical wrongdoing. It ignores the lived experience of people today and fails to acknowledge the impact of racism and racist policies on their lives. Marginalization is not a passive process. Communities are being actively disenfranchised today by policies created and enforced by people in positions of power. These partial narratives of historical injustice create the space to absolve policymakers and healthcare institutions of their roles in maintaining systems that are actively harming people. This is an important and necessary distinction that places the onus of bridging the trust gap squarely where it belongs, on those in power. This language of distrust around vaccines is too imprecise. The distrust is actually a lack of confidence, which Merriam-Webster defines as faith or belief that one will act in a right, proper, or effective way. Lack of confidence that institutions will act in a right, proper, or effective ways is a direct response to historical and current actions and inactions of those bodies. This context is important if policymakers hope to reach communities of color and bridge the confidence gap. Health and healthcare disparities are crushing communities of color in this country. Healthcare systems and their practitioners play a significant part in this. Relative to white people, Black people are less likely to have their pain adequately treated. Black and indigenous women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women, regardless of education or socioeconomic factors. Or consider the current state of HIV/AIDS, a pandemic that emerged in the U.S. in 1981 and has not yet been quenched. In 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention projected that at current rates of HIV transmission in the U.S., the lifetime risk for infection for Black, gay, and bisexual men is 1 in 2. Compare that with 1 in 4 for Latinx, gay, and bisexual men, and 1 in 11 for white, gay, and bisexual men. The CDC routinely conducts HIV behavioral surveillance of persons at high risk for HIV infection. In the 3 years following the CDC's projections for lifetime risk of HIV infection from 2017 to 2019, Black and Latinx, gay, and bisexual men consistently reported less awareness and significantly less uptake of HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, an effective intervention to curb transmission, compared to their non-Hispanic white counterparts. Systematic marginalization has measurable consequences and palpable outcomes. Many people of color have had bad healthcare experiences or have lost loved ones to the shortcomings of the American healthcare system. In many of these communities, there is a collective understanding that blind faith in this system, a system that has failed them time and time again, can lead to poor outcomes or even death. In this context, distrust in vaccines or the healthcare system as a whole is a logical reaction and a protective coping response to overwhelming adversity. Today's institutions were not created out of thin air, and they do not exist in history-free vacuums, immune to the influence of politics or larger societal problems. U.S. healthcare institutions have their own troublesome past and current practices that operate on theory developed by people deeply invested in maintaining white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal power structures. But all is not lost. We have the great opportunity to create a new culture of public health. Among people of color asked to join COVID-19 vaccine trials, worries about inequities run deep. As jurisdictions design their COVID-19 vaccine programs, I urge them to turn to the newly revised 10 essential public health services as a framework for direction, which puts equity at its center. Originally developed in 1994 by a federal working group, the revised framework was developed this fall by the DeBeaumont Foundation, the Public Health National Center for Innovations, and a task force of public health experts. To communicate effectively and build trust in communities, policymakers and institutions must center equity and account for the ways that systemic racism affects their public perception. To meaningfully address the public health crisis of racism, a pandemic of racialized trauma. Institutions need to improve and innovate their approaches through ongoing evaluation, research, and continuous quality improvement. This will require a paradigm shift on both personal and institutional levels. To create equitable vaccine programs, we must go beyond addressing historical trauma and account for the traumas people experience in the here and now. Racial trauma is like other forms of trauma. Its impact is widespread. It is intergenerational, and it can have severe social, physical, and psychological consequences. We already have proven public health frameworks, such as trauma-informed care, to address trauma. It's time to broaden their application. Trauma-informed care would provide a useful framework for public health institutions and policymakers to contextualize collective racial trauma as they build their COVID-19 vaccine programs and engage with communities that have experienced healthcare-related racial trauma. Trauma-informed practice understands and considers the prevalence of trauma, the complex impact it has on people's lives, and promotes healing and recovery rather than practices that may inadvertently re-traumatize. Recognizing that government and healthcare institutions have played roles in the traumatization of communities is key. Similar to rifts in interpersonal relationships, healing the fractured relationships between the healthcare system and communities of color will take time and will not always be comfortable or easy, but this is necessary work. The method should actively promote cultural humility, avoid blame, and acknowledge the wounds of the past and present. Efforts should prioritize transparency, safety, and preventing re-traumatization. To earn the trust of communities, institutions must show them that their concerns and needs matter. They should work with communities and hold themselves accountable to them. For any hopes of a successful vaccine program, public health institutions will need to continually demonstrate their commitment to healing, empowerment, and collaboration as we together create pathways for recovery, a commitment to act in a right, proper, and effective way through policy and action. Okay, well, next up I have a story from The Hill, and I'm placing it here because this is good news in the sense it's the FDA authorized the first fully at-home, over-the-counter COVID-19 test, but as you'll see, it may not connect with the average person on the street. The Food and Drug Administration last Tuesday granted emergency authorization for the first over-the-counter, fully at-home test for COVID-19. The move is a significant step forward in expanding the reach of rapid, at-home coronavirus tests, something experts have been advocating for months. Still, there will be limitations on supply, and cost could be a barrier to widespread repeated use. Today's authorization is a major milestone in diagnostic testing for COVID-19, said FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn. By authorizing a test for over-the-counter use, the FDA allows it to be sold in places like drugstores where a patient can buy it, swab their nose, and run the test and find out the results in as little as 20 minutes. The test is made by a company called Ellium. People swab their nose and then use a Bluetooth-connected analyzer that sends their results to their smartphone, the company said. Okay, I'd like to just stop there. First of all, as a person who doesn't even own a cell phone, let alone a smartphone, that would not work for me. There are actually a lot of people in this world who do not have a smartphone. That is not very good on the access and equity plan. Okay, the company said it plans to have 20 million tests available in the United States in the first half of 2021. The FDA said 3 million tests would be produced in January. Now, to give you an idea of scale of that, we're testing upwards of 1.8 million people a day, and they're looking at having 3 million tests produced in January. Okay. That is a significant number, but far less than hundreds of millions that would be needed for the goal some experts have advocated of allowing every household to have access to a cheap $1 paper strip that could be tested multiple times a week, helping people return to work and school. Some experts have pushed the FDA to move faster in authorizing new tests, saying it has been too concerned that making sure they fully live up to the highest accuracy standards. A spokesman for Ellium said the company's intention is to price the test at $30 or less, adding that while our initial investments in manufacturing are very large and the initial price may be higher, we are aiming to make this product as accessible as possible. The company said it received $30 million from the National Institutes of Health program to spur test development, which helps speed up development. The test correctly identifies 96% of positives and 100% of negatives in people with symptoms, the FDA said. In people without symptoms, that was 91% of positives identified, 96% of negatives accurately. The FDA said people should treat positive test results as presumptively true and isolate, but also confirm the result with another test. People with negative results should follow up with their doctor if they still have symptoms, the FDA said. This test, like other antigen tests, is less sensitive and less specific than typical molecular tests run in the lab, said Jeff Shuren, head of the FDA Device Center. However, the fact that it can be used completely at home and return results quickly means that it can play an important role in response to the pandemic. Of course, there's a vast difference between the $1 test strip and a $30 home device. I know a lot of people, if not most people, would not be one dishing out $30, you know, every week or multiple times a week in order to do testing. That would be out of the reach of many, and certainly many of the people that are high at risk are also not of high income. Okay, well, there's always a lot of bad news, but I would like to finish with one story that involves hope for this holiday season. This from Science Daily, how hope can make you happier with your lot in life. Having hope for the future could protect you, could protect people from risky behaviors such as drinking and gambling, according to a new research from the University of East Anglia. Researchers studied relative deprivation, the feeling that other people have things better than you in life. They wanted to find out why only some people experiencing this turn to escapist and risky behaviors such as drinking, alcohol, taking drugs, overeating, or gambling, while others do not. And they found that the answer lies in hope. Postgraduate researcher Shahryar Kasharvars from their school of psychology said, "I think most people have experienced relative deprivation at some point in their life. It's that feeling of being unhappy with your lot, the belief that your situation is worse than others, that other people are doing better than you." Roosevelt famously said that comparison is the thief of joy. It's that feeling you have when a friend buys a new car, or your sister gets married, or a colleague finds a better job, or has a better income. Relative deprivation can trigger negative emotions like anger and resentment, and has been associated with poor coping strategies like risk-taking, drinking, taking drugs, or gambling. But not everyone scoring high on measures of relative deprivation makes these poor life choices. We wanted to find out why some people seem to cope better or even use the experience to their advantage to improve their own situation. There's a lot of evidence to show that remaining hopeful in the face of adversity can be advantageous. So we wanted to see if hope can help people feel happier with their lot and buffer against risky behaviors. We looked at the people who scored high for relative deprivation, the ones that thought their situation in life was worse than those around them, and we looked at those who also scored high for hope. We found that the volunteers who scored high for hope were much less likely to take risks in the game. Those who weren't too hopeful were a lot more likely to take risks. The research team says that nurturing hope in people who are unhappy with their lot could protect against harmful behaviors like drinking and gambling. Well, I hope that that's good news for many of you. Well, that does it for the show. So if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up this show, re-listen to it, or get future shows as they come available at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you want to be notified through Facebook, you can look up Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM on Facebook. Like the page, and when I post these audio files, they will be available at some point before the actual broadcast over air and on the internet. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always." And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.